Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Sally Coulthard. Sally is an author and columnist. She has written more than 25 non-fiction books, and she has a column in Country Living. She now lives on a North Yorkshire smallholding. Her previous books include A Short History of the World According to Sheep, Floriography, The Book of the Earthworm, and The Bee Bible. I'm going to talk to her about The Barn. Published on the 11th of November, it is a history of one building on a North Yorkshire farm, but also a history of so much more, of Yorkshire folklore, culture, and traditions, and a history of the changing shape of English agriculture from the 16th century to the present day. Subscribe to The Critic Books podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you never miss an episode. Sally, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast. Your most recent book, The Barn, is about the lives, landscape and lost ways of an old Yorkshire farm, but it also tells the story of so much more. How did you first become interested in The Barn and the history it tells?
Well, thanks ever so much for having me to start off with. It's a real pleasure. So we bought the farm here about maybe 15 years ago. And it came with a farmhouse and a sort of set of fairly sort of derelict buildings. And as with lots of kind of people who run small holdings and farms, we were desperate to find different ways of earning some money. So we decided to try and rent out the big stone barn here on the farm to local artists, see if we could get some people in renting studio spaces in the barn. I mean, it's fairly rustic, but we figured that, you know, sculptors and painters might like the space. And so while I was clearing out one of the spaces in the barn, I uncovered on the wall these amazing witches' marks. And I have a degree in archaeology, but I had no idea what they were. So I called a friend and they told me that these were kind of, they're called hexafoils. They're designs that were scratched into buildings, all kinds of different buildings that you find in the countryside, by people from the kind of medieval period right up until the end of the 18th century. And they're essentially kind of prayers, or they're doodles, they're sort of a message or a kind of good luck charm that asks for, it can ask for things like a good harvest or just generally good luck or, you know, help with a disease or lots of different things. It's basically a kind of superstitious mark. And I thought that's so interesting. Because it took me back in time instantly. It was a great way of suddenly kind of getting in the minds of people who lived here before. Because essentially you don't really think about the people that lived in your house before you did. And it set me on a journey really to try and find out more about the people that lived and worked here on our farm and whether the barn could tell me something about those people and what kind of changes they went through in society and on a local level.
I think that's so interesting. What really struck me from the beginning of your book right the way through is from the witches' marks that you just described to the slip gill where the bodies of the Iron Age sacrifices were found, and also the corn dollies that were made at the end of harvest to preserve the corn spirit. There's always this presence of the ethereal, the magical, the pre-Christian, and the pagan as well as the Christian as well in the countryside that you describe. Could you talk any more about this, or what was it like?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing that you've picked up on, because I think essentially rural life for a long time until very recently, kind of Christianity and superstition sat side by side, and there wasn't really any conflict between the two in the sense that people could be Christian and have the Christian faith, but also genuinely and truthfully believe in, you know, the devil, witches, the power of kind of malevolent spirits and fairies and that kind of thing. I'm not sure why that is, but I suspect it's because beliefs in kind of superstitions served a useful function for people in the sense that it kind of helped them explain the things that were happening around them, but also perhaps unlike Christianity, which maybe felt very removed, gave them a sense of agency about their own lives. So for instance, if you could do something practically around your farm, like scratch some witches' marks or hang up a lucky charm or something like that, you were actively doing something that could maybe, you know, help your daily existence or improve your chances with the crop or all that kind of thing. And so rural life has always kind of had that duality. And like you picked up from the book, it's, you know, it's ancient. It's part of who we are as a country.
Yeah, and it goes really so deep. There's a chapter where you talk about how the British were scared of the potato because of its Catholic overtones.
Well, do you know, it's so funny because the potato now is such a kind of ubiquitous vegetable. You know, we see it as kind of quintessentially part of the English Sunday dinner, don't we? But until, you know, presumably sort of 1600s, it wasn't here. It wasn't part of our diet. It wasn't part of our culture. And so anything that kind of came from, because it was involved, because the Spanish were involved in New World colonization, and they were the people that brought across the potato initially, and the Spanish were a Catholic country, you know, Britain was deeply suspicious of anything to do that was involved in kind of, you know, Spanish trade and that kind of thing. And I think they felt that it was a kind of way of the Spanish trying to kind of infiltrate English society, and that it was this kind of way of trying to persuade people to kind of take on Catholic ways. And I mean, it's incredible. They used to think that, you know, potatoes were poisonous or were only fit for kind of animal food. And it took a real PR stunt on the part of the government and the church much later on, actually more like the sort of end of the 1700s, to actually persuade people that these things were kind of nutritious and could help people. It's extraordinary, isn't it, to kind of think about it.
It's completely bizarre. It's so much of our life now is dictated by the ways in which people farm, and I think that's also what we really don't understand, is how much of just modern life has changed through people choosing different crops to farm and everything, which is really, really interesting.
You're so right. And I'm currently just about finishing a new book, which is called Foul Play, and it's the history of the chicken, which sounds like it wouldn't be very interesting, but it's actually been fascinating because until the beginning of the 20th century, really, we didn't eat chicken. You know, it wasn't a kind of everyday food. And I've been sort of exploring how different things influenced how the chicken went from being this kind of amazing exotic creature or a luxury food to something that now people buy by the bucket, you know, and it's kind of, it's not even seen as an animal anymore. It's just seen as a kind of commodity. And so what people farm has changed hugely over the years and is often influenced by things that you don't expect when you start looking into the story.
Yeah, definitely. On another note, throughout the book, there's this kind of Thomas Hardy is very, very much present, and he very famously wrote about a kind of fictional area in the south of England, Wessex. But from his description of slaughtering a pig in Duty Obscure to the itinerant harvest workers in Far From the Madding Crowd, his description of 19th century rural life also maps onto your non-fictional description of rural life in Yorkshire. So how did you find the link between Yorkshire and Wessex and the ways of writing about that?
So one of the kind of challenges when you're writing a book about rural history is that it's not often accessible in a way that, say, urban history is, because it wasn't seen as hugely interesting. The lives of kind of the rural poor weren't massively interesting. And so often people's voices are quite invisible, or daily life is quite invisible in the kind of historical record. And so I found that often reading, and obviously it's fiction, but it's based in I believe that Hardy and other writers too, like people like the Brontes, really understood the countryside and describe it in a really beautiful and real way. And so for me, their kind of descriptions are a kind of shorthand into those kind of past lives. And, you know, Hardy wasn't kind of sentimental, although his books are sentimental in a way, in the sense that, you know, well, certainly Far From Madding Crowd, you know, it's got a kind of happy ending, and, you know, it's a kind of ripping read. I don't think he's sentimental about the countryside, and that's what I really like. You know, he understands kind of landscape and rural people's lives, but he also understood how tough they were and described the kind of toughness and the lack of stability and the relationships people had within the countryside. And so I'm really drawn to kind of writers like him, and like I say, like the Brontes, or you know, people who sort of just kind of naturally write about the countryside as a kind of background without kind of being too forced.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think one thing that really comes across in both Thomas Hardy's fiction and your book is you're overwhelmingly struck by just how difficult people's lives are and were. But you were talking about, there's a really interesting chapter about the lack of water, safe water in the village, and then the lives of people who sunk wells, or the lives of domestic servants and farm servants, how they were expected to work so hard, especially very, very young girls. Throughout all of the centuries that you describe in the book, you're unable to avoid how difficult people's lives were.
I think that's true. And I think that's one of the key takeaways I've found, is the more I kind of research about, you know, Victorian life or Georgian life, and going even further back, is that I'm under no illusions that there's no kind of bucolic idyll, and that rural life was overwhelmingly really tough for people. I mean, there's lots of happy moments, and, you know, the festivals and the access to nature and the relationship with animals, those are kind of things are really lovely parts of rural life. And I'm sure people who lived in and worked in factories in industrial cities and things would probably miss the countryside on elements of it. But that was the thing that really struck me, was just that, you know, rural life was just grind, really, and grind for the whole family. And so women's lives were tough, men's lives were tough, kids' lives were tough, as you say. You know, it was like a game of snakes and ladders. You know, even if you were well off one minute, you know, it wasn't difficult to kind of lose a fortune, and, you know, people could kind of go from rags to riches and riches to rags back again. And so I find that really fascinating, because it then puts into relief all the amazing things that people managed to do. So, I mean, we were just talking beforehand about the power cuts over Yorkshire, you know, last weekend and things, and just for kind of a couple of days, having no electricity and no heating, things like that, was really challenging when you've got a family and you're trying to feed animals and all that kind of stuff. I cannot imagine how exhausting and all-consuming it must have been to have to source your own water, to not have electricity, to have no mechanized transport, all these kind of things. For me, people from that kind of era are heroic. It's just extraordinary to think about. You know, we live at the, and I describe it in the book, that we live at the bottom of a hill, and to get to the main road, you've got a really steep climb. And so all the people that would have lived and worked on the farm would have had to somehow get the produce from the farm to the top of the main road to then take it off to, you know, market, or to the canal, or to the river, or whatever was closest. Even that, I just think, how the hell did they do it? You know, like, they would have had a couple of horses, a couple of kind of working horses and a cart, but it's a fair old climb, and it's a fair old climb in a car, never mind with kind of animals. And I'd love to go back in time and just see, just for a day, how people actually manage the kind of practicality of that kind of existence, because it's beyond me. I can't imagine how people did it.
No, it's so difficult. And you talked about how people in cities might have missed aspects of rural life, but I think one of the most interesting and kind of shocking things, in a way, that you described in your book is that people who worked in cities and in factories in the 19th century may well have had better access to meat, dairy, eggs, butter than their rural counterparts did, because they were able to buy them more. Yeah.
I mean, it's the ultimate irony, isn't it? That the people who were growing the food and raising the animals weren't actually able to afford the things that they were buying. Because you have this kind of image, and I certainly did before I started the book, that however bad it was in rural life, at least you had fresh milk, cheese, fresh meat, you could go and pick flowers or vegetables and herbs and that kind of thing. And so you had access to, and while that's partly true, because, you know, people would have foraged and eaten, you know, well, people were very suspicious of fresh vegetables and fruit anyway, but that's a different point. But that rural wages were so desperately bad that people couldn't afford to eat and buy the things that they were making. And so as you've picked up from the book, you know, a mill worker's family who were working in Leeds would have probably been earning twice as much as a rural family when wages were depressed. And so, you know, it wasn't the people in the countryside who were having, you know, big joints of ham and bits of, you know, fresh milk and things. It was the people living in the city. It was people living in the cities. And obviously there are huge, you know, there's a huge difference between people who are, you know, living in workhouses in urban environments and, you know, the super rich and things. But on a very sort of general level, yes, people who were living in urban environments had better wages, and mining communities and things like that were even better paid, even though the work was awful.
Yeah, and I think when we think of that period of history, we often think of the rush for industrialization and novels like North and South. That's the big change that's happening in the country. But something you made really, really interestingly clear in your book, The Barn, is that there's also a huge history of modernization and not so much industrialization as just change in rural practices, from enclosure in the 18th century through to the development of artificial fertilizer to the use of tractors rather than horses. How did you find drawing links between so many centuries of incremental and huge change?
Do you know, it's interesting that you use the word industrialization, because I feel like it was a kind of industrialization of the countryside, because essentially the principles were the same behind it, which was efficiency, applying machinery, using less labor but to get more end result, you know, being more productive, and also changing the relationship between worker and employer, to, you know, and all these kind of, you know, they mirrored a lot. There is a lot in common between the Industrial Revolution and the Agricultural Revolution. Much more than, it is about changing what crops we grew and being more productive in that sense. But really what it's about is making agriculture a business and profitable and growing and exponentially growing, not just to kind of be self-sufficient like we used to be, but actually to be able to export food, to be able to, you know, for people to make genuinely, you know, large amounts of money from farming. So yeah, I think you're right. It was a kind of industrialization of the countryside, really.
Yeah, and I think every single story that you ended up telling is just more and more bizarre, from the thing about turnpike mania, where trusts were set up to put tolls on roads, to, again, the lime burning and the well sinking. Every single move that was made was either more bizarre or more dangerous until we arrived at the state where we are now, which is really interesting.
Yeah, it is. And you know, you do sort of sometimes think, well, you know, maybe we have to go through these things to kind of come out the other side, and, you know, and no change is easy. But it does seem to have been a spectacularly dangerous time, doesn't it? The kind of end of the 18th century, but especially the 19th century, when things were so rapidly changing and the world was opening up, you know, and for trade and for kind of exploitation. And, you know, most of the people within that kind of system were fairly expendable, really. You know, you talked about the kind of fertilizer thing, and that sounds like it would be such a dull part of the book, but actually I found it fascinating writing. You know, understanding that the need to grow more food, i.e. crops, meant that the soil was becoming quickly depleted. So farmers had to do something to make the soil, to improve the soil like they do these days. So suddenly you had to have the need for fertilizers. Now, where the hell do you get fertilizers from? Because, you know, they didn't have artificial fertilizers. And so then that leads to people experimenting with different things and trying lots of different disgusting things. But then, you know, finding that bone, ground up bone, was brilliant for improving certain aspects of the soil health. And so then that led on to kind of bizarre side stories about the fact that we imported thousands of tons of dead buffalo bones from the plains of America, where the buffalo are being killed as part of a kind of strategy to displace the native people there. Or that, you know, we, as Egypt was being excavated, often by European archaeologists, lots of the bones ended up from excavations on our fields, or, you know, cemeteries were being dug up, or and that the bones were being ground in the workhouses and used as a form of kind of labor for people in workhouses to kind of earn their keep, as it were. But the workhouse conditions were so poor that people ended up eating the, you know, the marrow out of the bones that they were supposed to be grinding. And so you find that kind of like what is sensed to me on the face of it seems like a really boring story about artificial fertilizers and how farmers improve the soil suddenly turns into a story about all these kind of areas of life that farming touches. And you, I find it fascinating.
I found the same thing when I was reading a book. I was trying to describe to people what I was reading about, and they were like, surely that's not that interesting. I'm like, no, it's genuinely fascinating.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that you've been having to explain it to people.
No, I think I've got a lot of people to read it now, but it's stuff like the turnip story, the development of the turnip and things like that, when you're trying to explain why that's so genuinely fascinating.
I know, but even at the time when people were kind of, you know, some improvers were really into kind of turnips, people at dinner parties were saying, oh my God, you know, this person's talking about turnips. It was boring even then. But actually the end result is that it's fascinating. It was a really kind of key part in the agricultural cycle that allowed us to have loads more livestock, which meant loads more meat. We, you know, we could grow more crops, all those kind of things. And it's all linked in. But I love all the stories about kind of prized turnip, you know, growing. I mean, the Victorians were super competitive about everything and loved a competition, you know, loved a prize. And I just the idea of people kind of comparing turnips and, you know, growing absolute whoppers just killed me when I was writing it. I love kind of little glimpses like that in the past.
I think it's so fascinating. You're struck by so much of history comes from small, tiny agricultural facts, which is really interesting. It's not really political, national history. It's agricultural history is probably the one we all need to focus on a bit more.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think because my background is kind of history and archaeology and taking, you know, a kind of broad view of kind of history, you know, so much of history is about big events or special people. And while that's fascinating and it helps us put everything into context, really for me, the interesting stories are the kind of minutiae, the day-to-day experiences of people. But by looking at the details, you often find then it then reveals a bigger story. It kind of takes you back out against to the kind of looking at things, you know, from a bigger picture. So, you know, understanding, say, for instance, so bringing you back to the witches' marks, you know, the more I looked into that, I found out that the witches' marks were made in about 1780, in a time of a kind of two decades of really tough weather and poor harvests. And so the people who were making those marks weren't just kind of making them off the cuff and in a kind of casual way. They would have been facing starvation or certainly serious privation. And so you think, oh my goodness, you know, like these are kind of, this is part of a bigger picture. And the fact that, you know, people in England could starve not that long ago is extraordinary to think about. And then that links into politics. And then you have to ask yourself, well, why were people being allowed to starve when, as a country, we were quite a sort of wealthy country? And so then that kind of, you know, you do get political narratives and things, but you've got to kind of unpick the detail first.
I think that's so true. It definitely reinforces the sense that there shouldn't be divisions between types of history, because you can learn so much from so much about so many people's real lives from small details, which is really fascinating. You mentioned there that people were at risk of starving not too long ago. And one of the things that really struck me in your book is you rely on some oral testimonies from people right at the very, very beginning of the 20th century. And they're talking about the ways in which the harvest happened just prior to World War One or just after World War One. And you get a sense that whilst we have moved on a lot since then, and there was the agricultural revolution, also there's so much that has stayed the same as well, which is really fascinating.
So true. So true. And for me, like even the 1950s were, looking back now, if we went back to the 1950s, I think we'd be quite surprised by how difficult some people's lives were. I mean, we didn't get electricity here on the farm till the 1950s, which I just find kind of extraordinary. But, you know, all the things to do with kind of, especially kind of between the wars or before the wars, that kind of, those kind of the sort of first half of the 19th century. I think it was a kind of really ambitious time in terms of, you know, Britain's place in the world. And, you know, we had a lot of things kind of, you know, we were quite confident about our place in the world. And yet we were still really primitive in lots of ways. You know, we had, you know, not really any sort of social care to speak of. You know, diet was fairly, still fairly ropey for most people. You know, education, although kind of compulsory education had come in for primary schools by then, it was actually really difficult to get kids there, often from rural communities, because they were still working at home, or they were working on the harvest and all that kind of stuff. And so really, it's not that long ago that things were still fairly archaic. And it's, you know, we're losing that last generation, I think. I mean, I have a friend whose mum I talked to for part of the research book, who lived in this village. And I mean, she can still remember, you know, there being not really many cars, and, you know, people got their groceries from people who came door to door, and she didn't really go to school that much, but she was forced to go to church three times on a Sunday, that kind of thing, you know, all these kind of routines that are going to be lost very soon, because the next generation after that, which is kind of my parents' generation, things really radically kind of moved on. And then you start to get, you know, sort of, you know, people kind of social mobility changing and that kind of stuff in the second half of the 20th century. So yeah, for me, it's fascinating, because it's not that long ago, really. It's within kind of touching distance.
Yeah, it is. And what you write about, although there were so many changes over time, it's very much a pocket that we've moved on so far from now, that I think it's so important that you recorded it. It's really interesting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And there's so much to say about stuff. And I like to find the humour in things as well, because, you know, for me, kind of writing books, I want people to kind of learn stuff, but I also want people to be kind of entertained. And I certainly found, when I was kind of doing my degree and doing lots of research and stuff, that so much of rural history can be so dry, because it's like the invention of the threshing machine or that kind of thing. You sort of think, well, it's interesting, but actually, what did it mean in terms of changing people's lives and that kind of stuff? And so I like finding the stories and the anecdotes and other things that kind of people go, oh my goodness, wasn't that awful? Or, oh my goodness, isn't that funny? Or isn't that relatable? You know, and I think that's maybe part of the kind of journalism background as well, kind of coming in. But I want people to kind of find it readable.
Yeah, I think that's so true. So now, when you're going around the barn and the farm, do you feel a different connection to all of these? You talked about wanting to travel back in time, but do you feel a different connection to all of these other people who've lived there before you now?
Do you know, I really do. And I think about, I especially think about the people that lived in the house, actually, because there's something about kind of imagining someone sleeping in your bedroom or cooking in your kitchen or that kind of thing. You know, it's all the sort of domestic stuff I find really kind of touching. But I started to look at agricultural buildings in a completely different way, and notice that, you know, so many of them are kind of redundant these days. And it makes me kind of wonder, like, what's their future? Because, you know, so much farming has changed out of all recognition, really. And these barns, which are such beautiful structural documents, you know, they're as important as the kind of period features that you get in historic houses, are kind of crumbling away a lot of the time, or just kind of, but I don't know what the answer is, because, you know, it's not necessarily converting them into domestic houses, because then you lose so much of the character, but you can't kind of preserve the countryside in, you know, in Aspic, and nor should you. So it's a bit of a challenge, really, knowing kind of how to preserve that sort of history.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really difficult to work out how we can all move on, as well as preserving the physical side of it. Yeah. Thank you so much. That was so fabulous. Sally Coulthard's The Barn is out now. Subscribe to the Critic Books podcast so you never miss an episode.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.